Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Adult Education on behalf of the Adult Education Committee in Nassau Church. We are so happy to have you here today, and we're starting a new three-part series, State of the Garden State, surveying the political landscape from under the State House dome. We have three experts over the next 3 weeks who will be guiding us and sharing with us their thoughts on what is happening around the state in this new state legislative election season. And we're so pleased to have Bergen Record columnist and TV commentator Charles Stile with us today, and Princeton native. And I will introduce him in a moment. But first, let's pray. Please pray with me. Gracious God, thank you for this day, this wonderful community, and for today's speaker. We also give thanks for our democracy, which includes our free press. We ask that you comfort Wall Street Journal reporter and Princeton native Evan Gershkovich and free him from the Russian prison where he is being held for doing his job as a reporter. Please keep him safe and comfort his family until he is free to do his job again. We ask that you open our minds and our hearts as we learn this morning about our New Jersey democracy. In your name we pray, amen. I'm so happy that we have Charles Stile with us today, and I am so glad that you're all with us. Charles Stile is a veteran political columnist for the Bergen Record, and you can find his commentating, his columns at northjersey.com. As a graduate of the College of New Jersey, Stile began his career at the Sentinel Ledger of Ocean City before joining the Princeton Packet in August 1983. In the Times of Trenton a year later, covering City Hall and urban issues. Moving to the Record in 2000 and becoming the paper's full-time political columnist in 2007. He has received numerous journalism awards, including the 2018 Silurian's Merit Award from the New York Press Club for columns on Chris Christie, and has appeared on MSNBC, The Rachel Maddow Show, and CNN during last fall's midterms. He and his wife, storyteller Maria Lobiondo, who has been with us on a number of occasions, are the parents of two grown children. Please welcome Charles Stile.
Excuse me. Well, I just want to say about that CNN appearance. It was, I spent a whole hour with Manu Raju in Somerville, and it boiled down to 8 seconds on TV. So I had family all over the country, all ready with popcorn and everything, and I got very tepid reviews, let's put it that way. Well, thank you for coming. I'm really honored to be here at this great institution. When I first came to Princeton for a job interview from the Ocean City Sentinel Ledger in the dead of winter, I came around and saw this big edifice, and I said, wow, this is, I'm not in Ocean City anymore. I'm not in the Pine Barrens. I'm in like a real substantial community, a world community. So, talking about New Jersey politics, I know is such a vast universe of stuff to talk about. And I've been invited to speak at the college, New Jersey, and other places, and I just ramble on. If I don't have a specific topic, I can hear myself droning. And the kids today, it's amazing, they have these laptops in the classroom. That's how they take notes. But I have no idea that they're taking notes. I think they're sending emails critiquing my performance back and forth without, and I could see them snickering. So when they start to snicker, I know I've talked too much. So I thought I would drill in today on a really relevant topic, and because I think it's a watershed moment that we've experienced here in New Jersey in the past couple weeks. But it's one of those watershed moments that has really not seeped into the consciousness of the public. And I'm talking about the passage of the Election Transparency Act. Now, I don't know if anybody, maybe some of you have been tuned to news of this in our diminished press corps, but I think one of the most significant moments in my almost 30 years down at the State House. Now, I've covered everything or been around everything from Christy Whitman's, a soft or street money scandal and Jim McGreevy's famous burnout and disclosure about an affair with an aide to Bridgegate, which we've totally consumed me as a columnist, which was actually a lot of fun to cover. And it was the most colorful story because it just every day opened up another trap door and another bizarre thing. And here's one of the great things. The culprit, this shows you how strange this, and the culprit, or the mastermind of the whole scheme, is now one of our leading political bloggers. That's an only in New Jersey thing. So we have that, and I followed Chris Christie and around the country, and I love doing that as a candidate, in his doomed candidacy for president. But the most significant, to me, really, this Election Transparency Act really is a significant event because it really distills what I think is a lot of important issues facing the state and democracy. I heard, the reference to saving our democracy. I really do feel that this really is directly related to that. And it's a sweeping, I guess generally speaking, it is a sweeping restructuring of our campaign finance laws. But in reality, it really is a gutting of our protections. And it's actually a two-pronged gutting. I mean, there's a lot of different provisions. But basically what it does is, on one hand, open the floodgates in unprecedented levels of campaign cash into our system, and at the same time, stripping our ability to enforce it. I mean, stripping. There's no real way to sugarcoat it. And so this 1-2 punch, I mean, there's been a lot of other provisions that have gotten a lot of attention, the whole dispute over how the executive director is going to be hired, and that got settled somewhat. But the real issue is more money at unprecedented levels, at the same time stripping the ability to check or enforce potential violations. And to me, that's a combination for disaster, and I'm really uncomfortable about it. And third, there's the other third part of this. This is all happening with, as I mentioned, in the context of a diminished press corps. When I first came down to the State House, there were 10 bureaus there. There was a New York Times had people upending everything. David Halbfinger was there. He's now the political editor of the New York Times, was just a tour de force. You had the Philadelphia Inquirer. You had the Star Ledger had, I think, 12 people in a crammed into that room. And the Trenton Times, there was me, Jim Hooker, and Jim Goodman fighting all the time and arguing over who's going to get the story. And Jim Hooker's, instigating the arguments all day long. But it was just a tremendous amount of energy and vigilance. It was there. And maybe we didn't write these monstrous exposés like ProPublica did this past week, but there were some. They would come and go. But the mere presence of us being there in large numbers prevented a lot of bad things from happening, or at least they looked over their shoulder to make sure they weren't doing something bad. And it's that presence that was there. It's gone. The new State House is opening, by the way, in the next month, and Phil Murphy's taking a victory lap over something that he didn't authorize, but he's going to be the first to enjoy this new, luxurious, revamped State House. The press row has been moved to the fourth floor, and it's got 10 little carrels. Like, if you go into the library, there's more space in the library in the second floor of the library than there is for press row. and no privacy. We used to have our own little rooms. Of course, we always put our ear in the hallway to hear what our competition was doing, but no privacy. And I think that does reflect the reality of the industry. I don't think I lay that at the feet of the government, but there's no vigilance. And I just want to give you a sense. I put this up on the board to give you a sense of how dramatic this is. Now, these are the new campaign contribution levels. Is this microphone loud enough? I'm good, okay. Now, part of the argument in defense of this new law is, you know, we haven't had an updating of our contribution levels. Inflation is killing us like everybody else. And thirdly, there's these new creatures called dark money PACs, which are very attractive to donors because they can give unlimited amounts of money to these independent organizations and they don't have to publicly disclose that they did it. And they can give unlimited amounts. So this is an offshoot of Citizens United Supreme Court decision 2010. That's a long story, but they are this new creature that's out there, and suddenly the state, the traditional politicians and their traditional campaign accounts have to compete with this alluring competitor called secret dark money PACs, which have some definite advantages that they can't offer because anybody gives to them has to publicly disclose. So to compete with inflation and dark money PACs, we need to raise up, we have to raise our contribution limits. So some of them, like, this isn't too alarming. Candidates, if you're going to give to a candidate for the legislature, you could give up to $2,600 per election. That's been doubled to $5,200. The legislative leadership now tripled their contribution. This is where it starts getting really egregious, if you ask me. These are the leaders of the legislature. They have these enormous war chests that finance all the races for legislature, all their members. They pay for they pick up the tab. $25,000, they've done very well with these $25,000 contributions. They have tripled it, 200% increase. Here's the state party, the same thing. If you want to give to the state Democratic Party or the Republican Party, tripling, $25,000, $75,000. That's just for the main party. But as part of this new law, they created this really strange new creature called housekeeping funds, which I'll mention in a minute. Same thing with counties. And then you have municipal, if you want to give to a municipal candidate, you can double that to $14,000. This is an enormous amount of money. But the most interesting one is this new creature, as I mentioned, this housekeeping fund. Normally, if I gave a dollar to, or $10 to a candidate, they're free to use that for anything politically related to their campaigns, their legal costs, their advertising, anything that's political. But now they've created this new housekeeping fund that will ask donors to kick in another $37,000 on top of the $75,000 for administrative costs, legal expenses, internet costs, all that stuff that you would normally pay with a normal donation. But now they've created this new bureaucratic component called housekeeping funds just as an excuse to raise another $37,000 and put pressure on donors to kick in more. So if I'm a donor and I'm a special interest guy and I want that contract, that state highway contract, I'm under pressure now not to give $25,000, but I'm talking, what is that, $112,000 just to the state parties. Now, that doesn't mean it's just limited to that. I'm contractor X, and I want that contract for, they're expanding the turnpike, and I want a piece of that action. I'm not going to just give to the state party. I'm going to give to the legislative leadership. I'm going to give to all the candidates who are up for re-election in that particular, usually in the majority party, and to the county parties. And what they do, usually, is this really sleazy process called wheeling, where they earmark the contributions to these other secondary accounts, and they then in turn give it to the main, to the legislative leadership. So if I'm, you know, the Senate president, I'm going to get money, well, gubernatorial too, but if I'm the Senate president and I'm in control of legislation that can affect that, I'm going to get from that donor, I'm going to not just get the straight up $112,000, I'm going to get about maybe $100,000, maybe even more from money that's wheeled in to the PAC. That's a really a rough description of it. I mean, it's a little more sophisticated than that, but that's essentially how it works. And this all is happening at the same time that they are reducing the ability to of the Election Law Enforcement Commission, which was founded 50 years ago to this month, in 1973, to investigate possible violations of campaign finance law. Under the old rules, you had up to 10 years to investigate complaints. And that sounds like a lot, but you know, there's a lot of legal work that goes into an investigation, and there's a lot of pushback and a lot of due process, and these things get tangled up. And not all investigations need that 10 years. Some 4, 6, 8 years. Some have gone on for a while because they're really contentious. They've reduced that 10-year window to 2 years. So if you listen to people who are experts in this field, they're saying 2-year window is ridiculous. That's, the statute of limitations is going to run out in 2 years. Most of these people are not going to be held accountable. There's going to be violations that get maybe a sniff of an investigation, and then the 2-year clock winds down and they're off scot-free. So this is happening. This is this dual impact of these two things: more money, less vigilance. And it's done so brazenly. That's the thing, with less press vigilance. And I'm not here to depress you all. I'm not here to depress myself. I'm starting to feel like I should have put something in that coffee. I'm getting so depressed listening to myself. But a couple of things that this illustrates, though, and broader things. I mentioned the press. This is another manifestation of the dangers of one-party rule. Now, the party in power in Trenton for the past two decades has been the Democrats, from the departure of Christy Whitman and the brief interregnum of Donald DeFrancesco. It's pretty much the Democrats have run the table. I think it's since 2004, they've had majority control of both houses. I'll check my red book on that one. But they have run the table with impunity. And even under the 8 years of Chris Christie, they ran the legislature in conjunction largely with Chris Christie, believe it or not. I mean, that's been a very interesting, that was a very dynamic, strange 8 years of collaboration. But the party is in power, and when one party is in power with diminished press, you have a recipe of abuse. And I think this is an abuse. I don't know really. I mean, they wrap themselves, the people who defend this wrap themselves up in all these rationales that, we've opened the door of transparency with this because, yes, there is a provision that does allow for, that does require some of these soft money groups to disclose for the first time. And I think that's good. I don't think it's going to end soft money, though, because there are technicalities with soft money that still make it very attractive for campaigns. So when you have one party, without fear of the press, without fear of public reaction or backlash, they're going to take advantage of what they want to do, and this is what happens. And that's one part of it. And the other part, yes?
The Republicans oppose this?
Oh, no, that's a great question. For the most part, there are few. Oh, no, no, they opposed it. Only a few voted for. And that's a really good one. I even wrote a little piece about this. Republicans, this is a win-win for the Republicans. They get to rail with moral outrage at the Election Transparency Act and then take full advantage of it. They'll be out there the first on the phone raising, I need 75. So, you know, good day for Republicans. But it also illustrates a need for a two-party system. I come from, I could say this as a columnist, this is one of the beauties of being a columnist, not being, when I ran it, covered John Thurber in the, you know, Paleozoic era of the Trenton Times way back then. But, I had to, you know, stay the straight line and not show my, I wouldn't say biases, right, but my predilections, I guess. I come from a Democratic, left of center Democratic tradition, in my heritage, my family's that way. But I do believe in a robust two-party system, and I always found that the New Jersey Republicans, the Republican Party in this state, was reasonable. And it was a reasonable competitor, from Tom Kaine, even to Christy Whitman, even though with her, I mean, I think we've been harmed by some aspects of her legacy, namely her pension bond plan and her tax cuts, I think, really hobbled the state in the long term. But it was a good, there was a really robust debate, really competitive debate. And I think some of the policies were that affected the state were kind of kept to the middle. Not always, but it was a more moderate tradition that we saw in our policy making. And now, you know, I under the Democratic regime, there are a lot of things that I personally agree with that they've done. But when you have this kind of absolute power, you do things really benefit your own and your own special interests and potentially your own pocketbook. We don't have any evidence of that just yet because of this, but it really worries me. And I guess one thing, last thing I'd like to say, and I'll open this up for questions because I can feel that, you know, that grind going on in my voice. I hear that drone going on in there. But I really hope, and I'm really holding out, hoping for a Republican rebirth. It's kind of weird to say that, but a moderate Republican, sensible, pragmatic Republican Party that focused on, you know, that forced the debate on tax cuts and regulatory reform. Not that I agree with all of that, but there was they moved away from the ideological nonsense and the culture wars. And the problem is that even here in New Jersey, sensible people coming from the sensible, moderate tradition feeling the weight of that albatross of the Trump era, the MAGA era, is really weighing down potentially good, responsible Republicans. I covered Tom Kaine's race last year for Congress. There's a guy who comes from, you know, the great noblesse oblige, moderate, sensible Republican tradition of this state. And he had to pander. He ran on the Trump agenda. And his position on choice was just really so convoluted. And if you really stared at it, it wasn't a choice position. It was totally, far to the right. It was a far right position. And I don't see the Republican Party resurging in this state and reclaiming power to a reasonable level until we see the great noxious cloud of Trumpism kind of shift offshore. And I don't see it happening because I don't see it happening soon. I hold out hope that it will, you know, happen, and a lot of these Republicans can come out from under their rock and declare their moderate legacy, their moderate position. So we need a two-party system. And we're at this watershed moment that really illustrates, I think, a lot of things that are troubling about the state and democracy. And I'll leave you on that sour note, and I will take any questions about, and it doesn't have to be about this. I just figured I would just drill in on this because it's happening.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Sure.
We're going to open it up for questions, but I want to kick it off with the first one. You mentioned the diminished press corps.
Yeah.
And it's also happening on the local level as well as the national level.
Right.
What can we, as people interested in promoting a free press, what can we do about it? How do we reverse this trend?
That's a great question. I think, from my point of view, is to get subscriptions, digital subscriptions, frankly, is really, there's no, the day of the printed paper is done. The next generation coming up only reads online. And, but not only that, I think, but to read and to engage. And I think, I really always believe that legislators react if they get two or three letters from constituents that, you know, criticize them or raise concerns. They don't want any grief. And so I think engagement is really important. And also engaging with the paper itself. I get a lot of emails all the time, and I answer as many of them. As long as they put their name to them, I get some real crackpots that send me some stuff. But I think it really is going to be an economic issue, getting digital subscriptions. You're going to see a lot of offers for get 6 months for a dollar, grab it. You know, we need it. That's really, I think, a very important thing, because they react to numbers, and as more people read and respond, the more they react. If they don't feel that, then it's just they're just going to coast to do whatever they want.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, thanks. Thanks so much. Just in terms of following up that comment and your response, we subscribed to the Bergen Record the day after your column appeared about this very issue.
Oh.
That your column on this Election Transparency Act was so insightful, so powerful. I only wish that everybody in the state would have read it and responded.
Well, thank you.
Acted on that outrage that we could all feel for reading it. But yet you're absolutely right. The way to try to support media,
yeah,
even if it's just marginal, is to subscribe and support and respond to those kinds of columns. But so I thought there was a strong two-party system in New Jersey, the Northern Democrats and the Southern Democrats.
Very good.
But let me ask a substantive question on this.
Actually, it's more complicated than that now. The South has been weakened, but go ahead.
Yeah, there's Middlesex, there are all these different power centers. But on this and other issues, while having a strong second party is an important solution, what you said earlier about the role of the press, even when there was a strong two-party system, suggests that it's not enough to trust ethics and integrity and other important issues to the two parties without the intervention of other voices. And given the diminished role of the press,
right,
what other roles, what other voices and influences do you see that might make a difference? Organizations from the outside that, like the League of Women Voters, are there other groups that can play a role in trying to push back against these negative influences and try to lead New Jersey in a more positive way?
I think that's a really important point. I mean, you mentioned the League of Women Voters. You know, I always kind of had a lot of respect for the League of Women Voters, but to me they were always the, you know, let's hold a nice, respectable debate at the community center, and we're going to provide coffee, and everybody's going to be well-mannered. That's my outdated vision of the League of Women Voters. But in reality, the League of Women Voters were like, you know, this was the bare-knuckled version of the League of Women Voters. And I wouldn't say they were that rough, but they raised the alarm on this, and they were all over it. And they forced the legislative leadership to retreat on this initially. They were so gobsmacked that the League of Women Voters had rallied the troops with some other groups as well, and complaining about the first version of this bill, which would have allowed the executive director of the Election Law Enforcement Commission would have made him a patronage hire directly under the thumb of the governor. And so they're just stripping the independence of the agency. So their ability should be, I got a complaint about a politician, I should be free and unencumbered to investigate this. And no, under this first version of the bill, that person would have been put right under the thumb of the governor for $175,000 a year. So that, I don't need to explain how that, I can if you like, but at how bad that is, how egregious that is. League of Women Voters hit the streets or the phones, and over that weekend, I got alerted, and Tom Moran, my colleague over at the Ledger, who makes me look like, that guy he's amazing. He knows how to throw a punch. And a couple others, and we all wrote columns over the weekend, and then they hit the press on Monday. Suddenly, that sets the hair on fire of Nick Scutari, the Senate president, and they retreat. Great. They laid in the weeds for a couple weeks, and they came back with a version of that was a little bit improved, I would say. Now, that's a small victory, but the corpus of this still marched on through without too much of a problem. And this, to me, is the 1-2 punch, as I mentioned earlier, is a problem. But yes, League of Women Voters, Institute for Social Justice, they're excellent. They've really impressed me. And Sue Altman's group, the New Jersey Working Families, New Jersey Policy Perspective, has emerged as a force in Trenton, and a respected force. And they have to find new ways to mobilize in unison. I think that's really how it happens. Right, and they're in every nook and cranny of the state, whereas, the Institute for Justice is mostly in Newark, and they have their presence felt with their membership, but you're right, they are everywhere, and nobody wants to hear from their local League of Women Voters. Representative getting in their grill on a Saturday morning while you're going shopping, here comes Mr. and Mrs. League of Women Voters, and they got a laundry list of grievances, and all I want to do is get a dozen eggs. Yeah. Yeah.
Charles, I want to sort of change the focus.
Sure.
You have been talking primarily about this one bill.
Yeah.
And how egregious it is. Mike, as I read it, the topic that you were going to talk about today is the state of the state of New Jersey.
Huh.
Now, you might not know that. And I understand that, and I might be wrong.
Well, that's a big one.
That's exactly right, and that's what I wanted to ask you. This is sort of it's either a softball or an impossible.
Put it up there. Go ahead.
But what do you think is the state of New Jersey?
Well, I don't think it's as bad as it depends on who you listen to. I think. Economically, we've rebounded. I think our pension fund, which was always to me the bellwether of our, it's sort of like an indicator, we're finally at least making contributions to it, but the underlying economics of that are still pretty bad, and I still think we're sort of whistling by the graveyard. I think there is going to be some structural reform on benefits that need to be discussed. I don't want to sound like, I'm from the Cato Institute or something here, but I really do feel that that debate is should be a nonpartisan debate. I think, on the whole, we're pretty solid state. I think there are some real chronic problems that get brushed aside year to year, and we saw the pandemic reveal a bunch of those. We don't have an unemployment insurance system that worked. Our New Jersey transit system has one of the worst record of breakdowns compared to other transit systems in the Northeast. We're still terrible. I mean, there's been more focus, but we still are taking a Band-Aid approach to the financing of that. And one thing I haven't really poked at, but I think we're going to put more attention to is our environmental vigilance. I'm not sure that we've really, I think we've let that kind of slide. And I think also this recent strike that at Rutgers exposed some of the other chronic problems that we've sort of divested in higher ed since the abolishment of the Department of Higher Education. I don't have the numbers. I want to explore these numbers. But I think our contributions to Rutgers and other public colleges or institutions has slowly eroded, and that has led to a higher reliance on tuition hikes and uncredentialed or part-time help. Adjunct professors and non-tenured track people are now taking increasing higher load or higher proportion of the coursework. 30% of all classes at Rutgers are taught by adjuncts and non-tenured track people. I mean, that's just outrageous to me. And I think this is an issue that's really going to be discussed now in the wake of this settlement. And so you have these kind of problems, and no one's really, those are definitely kick the can down the road type of problems. And nobody wants to really get their, roll up their sleeves and deal with them. And we have this surplus of now almost $11 billion. And no one has discussed, should it be time that we totally modernize our unemployment insurance system so that next time we have a crisis, people don't have to wait almost 6 to 8 months for an unemployment check that they're due in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, it was a disgrace, really. It's unbelievable. But nobody's talking about spending that kind of money or making that kind of investment. Nobody's talking about maybe a dedicated source of revenue for New Jersey Transit so that it can stop siphoning money away from its capital fund to pay for operating expense, things like that. But that doesn't, I don't want to sound like Mr. Gloom and Doom. I think on balance, if you compare us to a lot of other states, we're not that bad a shape. Sure. That's my, I feel like I'm state of the state message here.
I'm going to twist you back. So I've read some articles recently about ELEC and its inability to do its job.
Yeah.
Look at the Federal Election Commission. These commissions that we form tend to become rife with patronage, and that tends to tie them up. And so my question is, what's the alternative? I mean, I'm looking at the Department of Justice and sort of an expansion into someplace like the Department of Justice where you can have career people who consider themselves to be neutral. I'm not sure these commissions ever really work because of the patronage problem that invades them, whether it's a direct payment or whether it's just, patronage.
Well, it's a tough call. I mean, there are times when they have worked. I mean, it really, I think this is one of those things. I agree. I mean, there's always going to be a partisan tinge to these appointments to boards and commissions in New Jersey. It's just the way it is. But they tend to, the tradition has been to pick people of experience and who have respect and allegiances to both parties. Not always. I mean, Christie stacked the deck with a lot of hacks.
So that's really my question is there a way to get independence on these commissions?
I think you would have to set up, that's a tough call. I don't know. I mean, I think you would have to maybe create a legislative mechanism by which you require. And I think there are some, maybe you could probably check me on that, John. I think there are some that require a balance, a partisan, or at least they require the leadership of the legislature to contribute their people and the governor's office contribute a certain amount of people to a board. And that And then you have public members that are picked. I'm not sure now. I'm thinking that out loud.
New Jersey judicial appointments, starting with the Supreme Court, equal balance.
There's always been that, and that's correct. There's always been. Again, there's no formal rule for that, though. Right? I mean, there's no formal, since 1947, there's, when they reformed the court, the balance has always been, you know, 7 members on the court, the party in power usually gets that 4th member, but you have 3 from the other side. And usually the picks that you get are not really very, because of the screening process, you don't get a lot of hard ideological people up on that board. You just don't. So, it's a tough call. I don't know how you legislate that and still really control it. It really comes down to, right now, the people at the top and how they want to adhere to the tradition. I mean, you saw that under Kane. You had good people. I thought Christy Whitman put really good people on the board, by and large, on the Supreme Court. And it kind of flows down from the head. But to mandate that kind of balance is very tough. I don't know.
We have 2 more questions, yeah. Virginia, and then Mark.
Okay, well, I was going to ask about pay to play in relation to this, but because you mentioned the courts, I think I'll start.
Yeah.
Maybe only take one question. Why is the governor, what is the slowdown about filling judicial vacancies? It's a crisis. And it's really an underreported crisis.
It is. No, that's gotten a lot of attention, but you're right about it. It is a crisis because it's affecting the day-to-day lives of people. I mean, the people who are, you know, adoption cases, divorces, kids caught up in the middle of a bad divorce, a bad family situation, and the divorce is being delayed, so they have to continue living in this, you know, dysfunctional household, potentially dangerous household because of a lack of judges. So I think part of the problem, it's a combination, frankly, of legislative politics, and this comes back to the tradition of senatorial courtesy. I don't think this is the sole root of the problem, however. Senatorial courtesy simply means a senator can block any gubernatorial appointee that comes from a county they represent. So if I'm, you know, a representative from Mercer County and I got, appointment for a prosecutor, the Mercer County prosecutor, I can unilaterally block it without saying anything about it. I don't have to make any public disclosure. I don't have to give my reasons. I can stall that. Now, I can kill it. And it has happened. But usually what happens is they use this leverage to squeeze other things out of the governor's office. Well, we need this highway project. Oh, I need these other appointments. I need you to sign my bill. And until I get that, I'm not going to sign off on this. Now, sometimes you have a county like Bergen, you have 5 different senators representing each a piece of Bergen, and some representing pieces of Passaic, and they won't move off on judicial nominees until all 5 of them are on the same page. Talk about herding cats. I mean, I did this in 2013. I was writing column after column about this in Bergen County because the shortage up there was really egregious, and it took almost a year to get 5 to 10 judgeships agreed to, because of all the differences between the 5 senators. So that is a major problem. But personally, I think this still comes down to Phil Murphy and his lack of attention to this. I just don't think this, I think he's become, he's kind of semi-checked out, let's put it bluntly. I mean, he's running the Democratic Governors Association, he's chairman of the National Governors Association. He's clearly got his eye on, I call it the Justin Case candidacy. If Biden decides not to run, or bad happens to him, and nobody consolidates around, the party doesn't consolidate around Kamala Harris, why not put my hat in a ring? He's gone out and gotten his hair fixed. I don't know if you've seen this, the guy. I mean, it sounds like a capricious thing to say, but, you know, look, Chris Christie went and had snuck off to New York to get that stomach thing. You know, what do you call that, the band? Thank you. He went off and snuck off in the dark of night into New York. The New York Post found out about it, and so he could slim down for a run for presidency. Now, he laughed it off. You guys are just making a story out of nothing. And it did work for him for a while. You know, he did a little slim down. Same thing with Murphy. He's trying to poo-poo it. Oh, I'm just my beauty, my beautician, or my barber suggested, oh, you got a little hair here. Why don't you let it grow out? Yeah, just at the same time, the field is opening for the presidency. He's just letting his hair grow out now all of a sudden. And it's fulsome. I mean, it's really, he's really got it going on there. It's really, it's an amazing transformation. So I think my point of this is that I do feel that he just hasn't put his shoulder to the wheel on this issue. And there's just no way to put it. I mean, if he just hasn't really. And I think this manifested itself, by the way, in the ELEC problem. Because if he really was unhappy with the executive director, which he was, and there's a whole long story about that, and that's why he wanted control over that position, he should have had his own people on the board appointed so that he could call them up and raise complaints about this guy, and I want you to investigate that. You're my appointees. But he didn't do that. The board was comprised of Christie holdovers. He didn't have his people in place. So he gets a complaint about this guy, and instead of being able to call up his people, he wants to change the law so that he can have direct control over it. And that, to me, it's just laziness or lack of attention to it. And I think that's coming to haunt him in the judgeships.
Our last question.
An observation. Husband and wives can double those numbers, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And the question I had was, did the Steve Sweeney race or the close governor's race, did that indicate more competitiveness between the parties?
That's a good question. I do think maybe. I mean, I think there was a general discontent, anti-incumbent fervor that was directed at all Democrats in that election nationally, and I think it rose up here in manifesting in a close race for Jack Cittarelli. I think there was just a lot of Republicans came out in fury and anger at any Democrat. On the legislative side, though, because of the way it's redistricted, the way the districts are constructed in the state, I don't see. We're talking maybe there's 120 seats up for election this fall. I would say maybe 6 to 8 are competitive out of that. Well, let's put it this way: there are 40 districts, 6 to 8 are competitive. So there's multiple races. So it's a hard thing. And that's your first question. I just leave you on this anecdote. Yes. And John Corzine did this by having his mother kick in $37,000 for the Bergen County Democrats. She's living in Taylorsville, Illinois. And we're looking at the records. What is Mrs. Corzine giving $37,000 to Bergen County? So we called her up and she goes, oh, that's what John asked me to do. So, yeah, that was a real, she was really concerned about the plight of Democrats in Bergen County. So, yes, you can do that.
Thank you, Charles Style. Thank you, everyone.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We will continue our State of the Garden State series next week with Senator Andrew Zwicker,
Uh-oh.
If you live in the district.
Well, I might come.
Charles will come back. If you live in District 16, he is your senator. So we hope to see you.